the Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tom Lawrence, and Tony Bemis as the Beaver.
And this is episode 267?
247, Tony. 247. Number challenged.
We almost published too many episodes.
That's right.
What year is it?
Yep, that is it. Number challenged.
Number challenged. All right. What? You were not going to go with be a one, not a zero?
You know, we could.
Not for that intro.
Although.
I'm sorry. I blurted that out just because you said that. But no, our original episode name was, and I guess you can put whatever you want on the website, but it was going to be a one, not a zero. And that comes from a little robot repair place in Ann Arbor. I saw that they have a poster, big poster that says be a one, not a zero.
All right.
And I thought that was pretty cute.
Yeah.
So that's right.
This is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
Phil Parada.
And Tom Lawrence.
Okay.
All right. So Mary, what was your last couple weeks like?
Well, I started practicing for the Mackinac Bridge Walk.
Oh yeah?
I walked outside.
Are you doing that tomorrow?
No, Monday.
Oh, Monday. That's
Monday.
Right.
We're driving up and staying at Gaylord, and then we're getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning and driving up to the bridge. And for people who aren't familiar with this, the Mackinac Bridge connects the two peninsulas in Michigan, and every Labor Day they open it up to pedestrian traffic. But you have to go in one direction, so they bus you to the north side to the Upper Peninsula, and then you walk across to the Lower Peninsula. So
but
that's what I'm doing.
Gaylord, the city, isn't really that close to the bridge. Is it you only want to drive like 4 or 5 hours and then get up and drive the rest of the way? Or
mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Because it's a holiday weekend and it's too much. You can't get a hotel room.
People.
In
that makes sense.
Those darn people. Those like 40,000 people that do this.
Wow.
So
my cousin was upset by this because she wants to go to the UP, so she had to change her schedule around to go before the bridge issues.
Oh, yes, because they're closing it this year.
Oh, yeah, she's less than thrilled about that.
Yeah, I can appreciate that.
Yeah, she lives right by there, so they travel up and forth a lot, and they're like, no, they're screwing up. She had changed her camping schedule and everything. So.
Wow. Yeah, they're closing it for 5 hours.
I think it's a 5-mile walk as well. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct, Phil. Mm.
I would love to walk across your bridge sometime. I thought about that because, like, that's actually, is this a big bridge?
I'll be live tweeting it.
Can you walk on the metal part?
Yes.
Yeah,
a lot of people don't though.
Yeah,
I do, and I just kind of.
If you're not familiar with the bridge, the center lanes are like a metal grate, and you can look down
and see the water.
Yeah, it's how I don't know how tall it is. 1,000 feet? No, 200 feet.
Yeah, I don't know how tall it is, but the entire bridge itself is 5 miles long, and I know the last time I did it because this will be my third time is I took pictures of the expansion joints because because I knew no one else did.
Were they not expanded? So there was some
gap
partially,
there? They're partially. But that bridge is constructed so that it can move as much as 25 feet.
Wow.
Because, you know, the bridge is hanging between those two upright towers.
Right.
So. Okay, well, I guess that's...
Isn't it, like, technically longer than the Golden Gate Bridge, right?
Because
I thought that was the longest
It's much better looking than the Golden Gate Bridge.
Or, no, it's... It's either the whole thing is longer or like the center, like the suspension part in the center is longer.
Yeah, you know, I don't know.
Because I think it comes down to the debate of where does the bridge start.
It's the best looking bridge.
Because there's a long ramp up before you get to the bridge where you're kind of like, am I on the bridge? But that much into the land because of, I mean, the immensity of the bridge. Once you think about a bridge that gaps 5 miles is... It's pretty much that's cool. Like I've rode across on my motorcycle a few times, which is really neat. And it's also a very windy bridge, which is kind of scary.
Yeah, you can go on YouTube and
watch cars fly off.
Yeah,
of it.
Search for Mackinac Bridge wind. And there's one of this trailer. The guy they had a dash cam. This trailer in front of it. It's going back and forth. Then it hits the railing. And then the trailer falls apart. The driver has to stop. The guy behind him gets out, and they put all the parts of the trailer into what's left of it. And then
Phil's over here freaking out.
The bridge, Phil? I have. We took our honeymoon in the UP.
Yeah.
But it was just about a month and a half ago.
It was a white knuckle drive across the bridge both times that we went.
The only cars that fly off are the really light ones. Wasn't it like a Yugo? Oh, that's one of them.
Yeah. It was blown off it.
Well, you have like a Civic, right? Or but something.
Don't worry. You'll never, you don't have to worry about that.
Right.
Yeah. You don't drive a smart car.
And they don't even make Yugos anymore.
Well, any other
but if you dredge the straits, you probably find a couple.
The other thing, too, is the fact that when there's a storm advisory, they will shut down the bridge or they'll do what they refer to as escorted drives across the bridge. So they've long since, it used to be like, it's bad today. It's up to you if you want to go across. Now they're like, all right, we know this is going to be a problem. Park here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, and it's mostly a winter thing.
Wow, all that conversation from just what did I do in the last couple. Yeah. So yeah. That was pretty much it. I mean, I've been just doing stuff that's non-related to technical. You know, doing a lot of financial market stuff, my options. Mm. That's about it. Okay, next. Tony.
All right. Well, I went camping for 2 weeks. So I don't know if anybody's paid attention. We've had 3 weeks since our last recording.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah, so I went camping and then camping the next week, and then now we're back. Mm-hmm. But my open source stuff or computer stuff I've been working on is just last night. I blew away what I called my like virtual machine server, and basically it was just a Linux Mint box with a PHP virtual box running on it. And instead of running that, then I wiped it, and I just pulled the hard drive out, so I still have the original OS and everything, but I installed FreeNAS, and I'm in the middle of getting all the data copied over, and I still wanted to run VMs, and that's why I had waited so long, is because I wanted to make sure I had a FreeNAS version that had VM support. So they have Beehive.
It's the FreeBSD Beehive project that's built into it.
Right. So you can't just import a VirtualBox OVF file into Beehive. So what I did is I used CloneZilla to clone the drive, or clone the system back it up. And then on the Beehive, the new VM, I created a whole new VM, and I booted off of CloneZilla, and then I pointed at that backup image I had and said, restore it.
Wow, that sounds like a honey of a system.
So the issue was Beehive uses UEFI for boot, where VirtualBox doesn't.
Right.
So then I had to go through all these, 20 steps to convert the old system into UEFI boot. Mm-hmm. And then there's another, I don't know if it's a flaw or it's a flaw in one feature. System or the other, feature, yeah. Where
they both start with F.
It will only boot. It will only boot in from the boot drive sector or the boot partition if it's like EFI/EFI/boot/boot.x64 EFI. It won't boot from the actual grub, like the /Ubuntu/grub dot or whatever for EFI. Mm-hmm. So if grub updates, then you have to manually copy over that grub EFI boot file into the place where Beehive knows where it is. So what I did is I wrote a little script that says, check if these two files are the same. If not, copy it over. And I run it every 5 minutes.
You place that in a crontab?
Crontab and for root. And I just said every 5 minutes. So clever. If I just do, apt-get update and upgrade, then it will, it'll upgrade. And as long as I don't boot with in that, 5 minute slack time, if I don't reboot, then it'll get copied over. And then so all I have to do is remember, if I do the update, wait at least 5 minutes before I reboot, and then I'll be safe.
That's pretty clever.
Thanks. So I had two machines. So once I figured out how to do it on the first one, which took 2 hours to figure it out, and then the second one was a 10-minute process, got it all set, and then the script, I just copied it from one to the other, and it's all set to go.
Nice.
So, yeah. So now I just have to copy all the data over from my old drives into the new ZFS pools. So I'm going from 3 2-terabyte drives, which has all the data on it, and then I have 2 new 2-terabyte drives that I'm starting the Z pool with, or is that what it's called? ZFS pool? And then once I have everything copied from the one drive, then I'll stick that back in my machine, add it to the pool, And then take my next drive, copy all the stuff over, wipe it, stick it in the pool, you know, edit, and then until I have, I'll have a total of 5 2-terabyte drives in the system. So.
Yeah. I love FreeNAS.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And FreeNAS.
And what's the underlying operating system again?
That good old BSD.
That's right.
FreeBSD.
You know what I found interesting is one of the selling points for me, it was deduplication. But it's not turned on by default. I had to go in and say, turn this on. And it pops up all these warnings saying, oh, watch out. It might cause performance problems. And you want to make sure, you know, watch your system or be careful. And is that because of, like, the amount of RAM it needs to run the system? Or
yeah. How much RAM do you have in your system?
32 gigs.
Oh, you're fine.
I figured so. So I just turned it on all of them. Right. On all my
things. Just let it use the compression. I don't turn on dedupe. Because the compression is interesting on FreeBSD and also confusing if you're not used to it. It is tells you how much free space is on the drive, and let's say I have 100 gigs free. But when you say, okay, I got 60 gigs I'm copying, so you drop 60 gigs on it, then it says I now have what you would assume would be the difference. It gives you after compression difference. So you actually get to store a lot more on it than you think because it does by default have compression. So instead of deduping, I just leave the compression on, and I've never had a problem. But I've heard the deduping's good on it. So,
well, I specifically want deduping because I do have a specific set of
files.
You
have a lot of duplicates.
That are duplicates.
Okay.
No, and it's purposely done because in OwnCloud, it's not easy to NextCloud, it's not easy to have – I mean, it's easy to share folders, but it's not easy to have that translate into the actual working desktop. You know, so my wife was doing her project for our class, and we had 250 gigs of pictures, and she had to have access to that full picture library, but then I needed full access to mine, and I didn't want to have to make her go into the web interface to get to it all.
Yeah.
So it was syncing it back and forth, so you know, I didn't want her to delete it, and and you know, just to make sure it was like. In a place where she knew where it all was, I just threw it in my pictures folder, which then was on OwnCloud. So now I moved that over, and then I actually had a third copy of it that I was sharing out to everybody else. So three copies, you know, it's 700 gigs of pictures, dedupes down to, and then compresses down to 200 gigs or whatever.
Yep.
Oh,
so
200 gigs. That's quite small.
Well, that saves me 500 gigs.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's the way ZFS works with that is really amazing. So,
yeah.
We should probably do at some point maybe a fresh looks at how ZFS works. You know, we did a fresh looks on Michael Lucas's book, I believe, right?
Yes, we did.
Yes.
ZFS. Yep.
Yeah. And so probably talking more about how the ZFS file system works would be an interesting fresh looks.
You know, it would be even better. Maybe we could talk Michael
going to next.
That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Because me and him were going back and forth on Facebook for laughing about some things. So he likes some of my statuses, and I like a lot of his statuses. So we've had discussions. He's a great guy.
He is. Yep, he definitely is. And I know that they're interested, the semi-bug is interested in having you come out and talk about FreeNAS, I think it was. I don't know, what was it? FreeNAS. No, PFSense.
I'll do both.
Whichever.
There are two projects I've done
one
of
those
two. Stuff on.
So, yeah, because I've missed it. My timing has been kind of bad for their meetings as far as conflicts and things, so I'll try to do a better job. But I'll send a tweet to him. I'll send a tweet, direct tweet.
Okay.
And mention that. Yeah. See if he's up for that.
I'm all for it.
Mm-hmm.
It's fun.
Yep.
All right.
All right.
Well, that was my long thing.
Long
what
dissertation.
My stuff has been. Yeah.
All right, but it was interesting.
Oh,
far more interesting than just my walking.
Yeah. I do have one more announcement. I picked up a part-time job.
Oh, a side hustle.
I do. Yeah. It's what I call. I guess you call it a part-time job. I'm going to be teaching not Linux class, but a networking class at Eastern Michigan University.
Cool.
So adjunct faculty. So now I need to try to figure out if I can have Google refer to me as Professor Bemis.
When does that start?
Is this a paying gig?
Not this Monday, but the Monday after. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yep.
So do you have a curriculum already?
Yeah,
you're
I'm
just
using
gonna wing it.
No. I'm using the Cisco curriculum.
Oh, okay.
And then I'm like streaming it down a little bit and
sure.
making it, you know.
And how many weeks is this course?
It's a 15-week course.
Oh, wow. So that's almost 4 months.
It's a full semester.
What's it going to be called?
It's called Networking One.
Professor Bemis's Networking.
So the university doesn't teach two certifications. They teach general knowledge and practical knowledge.
Fanciful knowledge is probably one of them.
Well,
sorry, Tony.
It's a combination, you know.
I went rogue on you there.
Well, the reason they wanted me to teach is because I have practical knowledge of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so the course guide I'm using is the Cisco course guide that's geared toward the CCNA certification.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm supposed to like add in little things from here and there that's not specifically Cisco. And then we have to make like a disclaimer that this is not a training thing. You can't just go out and take the cert. And it's really, this is only one out of four classes to get your CCNA certification. It's actually class two out of the four. But yeah, so I'm doing that.
Very cool.
Thanks.
Well, you guys are looking at me, so I'll say something.
All right.
Speaking of FreeNAS, there are some shirts sitting over there that arrived from FreeNAS for me and my guys.
Oh,
and it's cool. All related to, and there's a letter over here where they drew the cool shark logo.
And Tony has proceeded over to the FedEx box and is demonstrating. Systems.
Yeah.
All right.
They loved our FreeNAS videos we were making on YouTube. We did a data destruction one on how hard it is. So we blew up motherboards while they were running FreeNAS, and we were pulling memory out of live motherboards while they were doing FreeNAS rebuilds.
Just a typical Tom Lawrence day.
Yeah. And finally, when we couldn't get anything to happen, we sent 30,000 volts through the motherboard while it was running, which did not destroy the hard drives, which shocked us.
But it did run up your electrical bill.
Yeah. And then we showed how – and I think this is something that a lot of people don't understand about FreeNAS is they think like, oh, no, I have to have – they think in Windows terms of I have to have the drives in the same order with the same controller. FreeNAS does not care if you change the motherboard. FreeNAS doesn't care if you change the order which you're plugged into the SATA. I've seen people label them. You don't have to. You can just take drives, power down my RAID array, which has I have a 24-bay array, and it's got a bunch of drives in it. You can rearrange them in any way you want and plug it in. FreeNAS uses identifiers on each disk
to determine part
of the pool.
Where is the brain that stores this? Where is that located?
And they do that for the reasons of the problem in the history of RAID, if you've worked in the older style RAID systems.
So it's like blockchain.
Yeah. It's a really cool design. Mm. Because the problem is they used to not write signatures on a hard drive. It used to care that slot 2 had a specific drive in it with a specific serial number. And then when you're physical hardware would fail, you would have the problem of unable to import it because the hardware failed, so you would lose all your data on RAID arrays in the physical RAID array world. FreeNAS gets around all that going, we don't care if your hardware dies, your data is what's important. So if your hardware dies, you can change out, just take the drive and import the Z pool as long as you have enough of the drive.
And
slots.
If it's out of warranty, they really don't care.
Yeah, if it's out of warranty, they really don't care. So yeah,
that was the biggest selling point for me because I have a RAID controller. But I didn't want to run it because in case the RAID controller dies, then I lose my stuff. So that's why I really like FreeNAS.
Yeah. We've done it before for clients where we had the RAID controller die, and we have to hunt down on eBay a matched RAID controller of that exact model to plug the drives into or it won't work. So there's no cross-compatibility. And a lot of people don't realize this, and the guys at Backblaze, great talk. People have cut part of the talk out because Backblaze is the definitive answer on this question. What's faster, hardware RAID or software RAID? And they didn't just say software RAID is faster. They're like, it blows it out of the water. And he also made a comment. He goes, we learned something about it.
Software RAID blows hardware RAID out of the water? Okay, I just want to make sure I understood that.
Yeah, that's why Backblaze.
I'm kind of surprised.
A lot of people were, and they said, here's the problem. We always made assumptions that these closed-source RAID controllers were written by geniuses who optimized everything in a really great way. Turns out they're not. And the software just happens to work really, really well. And they use I think Backblaze uses a modified version of ZFS for their storage pods that they have. They have a lot of tech, and they talk about it. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole talk where the guy goes, look, we've done the comparison. We're data center level. We're one of the big storage data centers out there. So we have very definitive information on this. Right. And they said it's really fast. Also, some people think you should run FreeNAS on a hardware array. Do not. Only just get a JBOD. Yeah, because that's what we're running.
Just a bunch of disks.
Just a bunch of disks. And yeah, the JBOD for that. So we did a lot of testing on it, and we got t-shirts and a cool letter, and they drew the logo with ink pen, which I thought was cool. The letter's handwritten. I appreciate that for keeping it and framing
really?
It.
Really? Are you sure it's not one of those robot pens?
It could be.
Because, AI is so advanced these days.
I would still keep it.
Remember how you used to get those envelopes and it looked like somebody handwrote something to you? And
yeah.
Then you found out, oh my God, there are robot pens that do this.
This has texture on the paper where they pushed on it. And who has notepaper with holes in it now?
I was going to ask, is that the letter?
That is the letter right there.
Well,
you can grab the fill if you want, but it is paper with holes in it.
Who wrote it?
The guys at FreeNAS.
Chris Moore? No.
I don't know.
Well, he's on the other.
This letter says, here are the shirts. Keep up the good work, and thank you guys for supporting FreeNAS. Looking forward to all your new videos. Go OSS, the FreeNAS team.
Oh, that's cool.
That's cool.
Oh, and they look signed at it.
And they drew a little...
Do a little shirt.
We had a lot of fun. We actually had some more videos that we haven't finished on FreeNAS. Well, we kind of finished them. So everyone wants me to test the bad memory. And that's been the absolutely hardest thing to test on FreeNAS because the OS keeps crashing.
You keep forgetting?
Because you keep forgetting. Yeah, so keep forgetting to test it. I should have seen it coming. That's actually a really hard thing to test because the way the FreeBSD works and the way address memory randomization, you never know at each boot where the kernel and some of the other functions are going to lie in memory. So if the kernel decides it's going to go to the part of the memory that's bad, the system won't boot. So it took like 20 boots to finally get it to boot. But then the UI would lock up, which is weird. The UI would lock up, but we still have access to the drives. But when the UI locks up, I can't initiate a scrub because I also couldn't get in from the command line. But it kept sharing files. So with the bad memory thing was hard, so it didn't make for a compelling video. So we never really published it because I kept getting aggravated. And the amount of time we put into it raised my stress levels because I'm like, I have no content, but I'm hours into rebooting this thing. Because there's a theory that you could lose your ZFS. But that's why I want to do an in-depth talk about why that is so unlikely of a scenario. Like, I think there's another factor why people lost it, and it has nothing to do with the memory. It's the way that ZFS layers everything with journals and how many journals there are, and the fact that before a new journal can be written, there's a checksum process that makes sure the journal's correct before it can be written. So to think that a bad memory would cause a checksum to match, what's the likelihood of that, Phil? It just couldn't happen if you think about that. You talk about the namespace collision on that. It's just impossible to have two journals match to pass a standard MD5 checksum with bad memory. It just, anyways, before I get any further on that, other things I'm working on is I might be moving over to Zen Server for our virtual stack because we use VirtualBox now. Zen Server is more efficient than VirtualBox, but it does not have the slick import-export as nice as, and we're talking about specifically the Citrix flavor of it. Citrix Zen Server, which run on CentOS. But it does work really well.
Have you considered KVM, which is kernel virtual machines?
I like something with a great interface for people who aren't me to run, which means my staff. And that's what PHP VirtualBox does a great job of. It makes a really easy import-export. It's a GUI. So, and the other thing about PHP VirtualBox is I'm running it on my laptop, I'm running it on my desktop. So if my server were to go down, every week I make backups of all my VMs. I could import my entire company and run it on my laptop. So I have, and that's actually my disaster recovery plan. I can import it anywhere if something occurs and instantly have it up and running. Versus if the Zen server dies, because there's no direct import-export from Zen server for VirtualBox, they say they do, it doesn't work. Because it handles hard drives differently. So we have to build another Zen server, so that's why I'm slow to switch. But, yeah, we'll figure it out. That's other than that, I've been riding motorcycles and scooters.
Either that or just set it on fire.
Set it on fire. No. And any disaster recovery plan, you just have to – is it's not just backups. It's about what would happen if – and that's the scenarios we play. What would happen if – this server took a complete dump and died. How quickly will my company back up running? Because if my virtual stack dies, we can't support our clients. We don't know their passwords. We don't have remote access to their machines because all that's hosted on my virtual stack.
you have to do the you have to actually initiate the plan. You have to test it and do fire drills. Because yes. it's all fine and great to have a plan until you get punched in the face and then your plan goes out the window.
Yes.
You have to make sure that your plan works.
Yes. That's my favorite Mike Tyson quote.
Yep.
Everyone has a plan until they get hit. Real poetic, but yeah. Hey, but it's really important. And that's another tricky I have with Zen Service. So if I build one here, I have to build one at home. Because one of my final tests are I take the virtual machines off site to my house because there's one copy kept here, one copy at my house.
Build it here and just take it home.
Build it here and take it home. Well, I take and I import the virtual machines as my final test, like Phil said, the testing portion. At least once a month, I import all of them onto my laptop one by one, make sure they boot, make sure they work, make sure I can get data. Then I destroy them and import the next one because I don't have a lot of room on my laptop. So, but I go through the process of making sure I can import each virtual machine to make sure the export worked fine. And I'm like, everything worked. Great. If I have Zen Server, I can't do that. Now, Zen Server will import and export back to Zen and back to VMware, but I then have to do that. So I'm going to try exporting from Zen and VMPlayer. Like I said, I'm super – because this runs my business and we have a lot of clients and I can't lose data. So this is a big, arduous process of change. It's hard for me because, like, you know, once it all works and you know it works, I don't really want to change it.
Yeah.
So – lots you know, of thoughts on that.
You know, Tom, one of the best things about you being on the show is that you just talk and talk and talk and talk.
You're probably right. I can just
and it's relevant stuff.
Yeah. Because this is what I do all
he quickly
day.
Added.
But
if you didn't add that, we wouldn't. Oh, I should shut up.
Yeah, we would have pummeled you with our fists.
It makes it hard to get in there. And so I had something like three conversations back I wanted to say. going back to the software raid thing and versus hardware raid, I wonder.
Oh yeah, that was a long time ago.
the thought of hardware raid being better is because of history. You know, it's been a long time and yes. it's been in place for so long. But back then, CPUs were so slow that software raid probably didn't run really all that well.
Very true.
So now with all the additional CPUs and you know the typical server running this kind of hardware. Is going to have, you know, 24, a minimum of 24 processors and more. So it's easily could run things
well,
like that.
Well, and one of the other things I talked about in my last vlog where I posted it was, one of the titles is the Psychology of Graybeards. And they are problematic because they remembered when their RAID array from 1992 worked awesome. And now it's 2017, and they refuse to change it because they remember that one worked awesome. Or the other problem with the graybeard psychology is they had an HP server fail on them in 1999. Therefore, in 2017, you should never, ever run an HP server. That one failed on me in 1999.
Right.
And they never want to change. They fixate on it. And I see that even one of my own techs, I pick on him a little bit because he gets fixated on certain things, and he doesn't want to change. It's really weird because we work in a tech field. Like, we literally should be fluid and open to ideas, but Phil's probably staring right at me because he knows, he goes, God, I work with some of these people.
Had a bad experience with an HP server. It drew first blood.
Yeah. But you know what I'm talking about. You probably have someone within a dev team you've worked with that is stuck on some, like, no, I only run this old version of this because it worked and I'm scared to try the new version.
I've come across that. Not recently, but I know what you're talking about. Yes, and it's always frustrating because it's like, come on, everybody, can't we see the light? It's 2016 or 2017
right.
Now. Technology has advanced. All you have to do is kind of try it.
Yeah, and that's one of those, you know, little things. It's an interesting concept, but I think there's weird things that techs will get fixated. They like a thing, and the progress stopped right
yeah.
there.
Yep, I agree.
That's why we call them the gray beards and stuff. Even though they don't have gray beards all the time, but it's the concept.
I thought you were just making fun of elderly people.
Oh, no. If you've been to any Linux conventions, you know who they are.
Oh, yes.
So, Phil, I don't think you've gone yet. What have you been working on?
I have been working on getting burnt out at work because of
how's it going?
it's always fun, but mm-hmm. I've got hard problems to solve. And it can get kind of boring when you feel like you're not making any progress, mm-hmm. but you're still learning a bunch. Mm-hmm. So that's been my last couple of weeks. Aside from work, things have been great. That sounded sarcastic.
But you've been at work all the time, so.
Yeah. It's hard because my gaming computer is in the same room as my office, so I don't have a very good split from turning off work fill mode to relax and have a good time fill mode. Oh. As far as I'm concerned, there is no relax and have a good time fill mode.
Yeah.
But life is good. I need to figure out how to get a better work-life balance. I think that's something that everybody should do. And if anybody has tips, please email show@smlr.us.
All right.
And your tip just might make it on the air.
Yeah, I have no tips. I'm obsessive.
We'll probably talk about all of the ones we receive, provided they make sense.
As far as tech projects go, my PF Sense box, it's been going fine. The only thing that happens is every so often a hard drive dies.
Oh, no.
I'm gonna chalk that up to me buying bad hard drives.
Wait, PF Sense?
Yeah.
You don't need a hard drive except for your boot system, right? Or is that your boot OS that dies?
Yeah.
So I keep an SSD in my little PF Sense box. Every so often that will just fail.
Oh, no.
But then again, I'm running tons upon tons of additional modules that do a lot of logging and writes to it.
Yeah. Yeah. We actually, and you're free to leave if you want to look at the ones we got in boxes over here. They come with MSATAs and everything. They're really nice. So.
Mm. Cool.
Especially the one that has 6 ports on it. So many networks. Ooh. 6 gigabit Intel ports on it. We did a review of it. Also, you should look at DNS thingy. We'll talk about that too.
DNS thingy.
It's a cool PF Sense add-on.
I like
for
thingies
DNS
and stuff.
Filtering. Yeah, thingies and stuff.
Oh, great. I didn't realize they had a PF Sense.
I did a review of it, and they reached out to me. I wouldn't sign the NDA, so they won't. They're doing a business one too, and if I signed an NDA, they would do it. And I said, that sounds no fun at all. I don't like NDAs. So they're like, you don't want to preview it? I said, I'd love to preview it. I don't want to sign an NDA. So that's where that conversation. We keep going back and forth, but we want you to preview it, Tom. And I'm like, I know. We'll give you 6 months free. That's great. When do I start? So you sign the NDA, I won't sign it.
Call that an infinite loop?
It really is. I'm very clear on this. And I'm like, why would you not want me to brag about your business product? Like, why am I saying NDA? What do I not talk about on it? If I do it, I want to talk about all of it. It's good for you. Whether it's good or bad, you're going to improve it. I don't mind feedback. I don't mind withholding stuff if there's some major flaw you don't want me to release. But I'm not going to sign an NDA that I can't talk about your product.
They're stuck in the old model of that they want control. Yes. At least the first communication about it, and that's really going away with all the social media and YouTube and everything.
It really is
out.
And I think it's better to be honest with your product, especially even if it has a flaw, but it's very beta, and that would be preface to any review I did. Is I've been offered a preview developer beta. That means anything I say, if I find a problem with it, will probably be fixed before it gets released. So why would I send an NDA for that?
Speaking of NDAs and I guess closed source things, Reddit, the gigantic reddit.com has now gone closed source as of
I seen that
as of September 1st.
Well, now describe gone closed source.
Money. Or big 3 name agencies.
Reddit, so it's a website, right?
Yes.
And content is still available for people to see,
just you can't see what runs everything that gets displayed to your screen.
The other side of that debate is Reddit has always, their secret sauce for their anti-spam has always been closed source. So the concept of Reddit was from when it was by its founder was they would give away the entire source code to run the news site, and anyone could download it. And that was kind of their joke, was anyone can make Reddit. You like the way Reddit works? All of the source code was kept and maintained open. But one of the big challenges and why no one ever copied it was the big deal with Reddit is the secret sauce that keeps people from spamming and things like that. And there's a lot of inside information. There's a whole report done on how to fish Reddit and things like that. And people are still getting around it. And they just keep that part closed. But now they're going fully closed. And part of it, as I understand, is because they're going to integrate further the secret sauce. So they need to close up more of it. Because if you could see the secret sauce that stops the spammers, then you would be easier to game it. That's their theory.
But I don't even think they're going to release a tarball of the code, like post-deploy. No.
And if there's something we know, things developed in closed source are not more secure. Just throwing it out there.
So, just saying.
So that's unfortunate. I've been reading a lot more Hacker News and lobsters.
Lobsters.
Lobsters is a technology-related website. It's lobste.rs, but it's not just technology. It's kind of nifty. I like it. Minimal UI.
Oh, yeah. It almost looks like a Google search without the with just only the blue links and no info below it. I mean, it's just a list.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very...
Spell that one more time.
lobste.rs.
I put Sweet. The dot in the wrong place.
Cool.
And they had to use a Let's Encrypt search, so that always tickles me.
Oh, yeah.
Awesome.
Right.
We should probably move on to the next section of our show. Or is this going to be...
What is that?
We're just going to have a round
table. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, yes, and we need to keep... Yeah, we do.
Well, are we going to... We actually have a structure
feedback.
This week.
Oh, my gosh. What?
We have a structure this week. All right. Yeah, let's continue on.
We want to hear from you. Call 734-258-7009 or email show at smlr.us with your feedback and questions.
All right. So we did get a few emails.
We did.
I saw Mary, you had replied to one of them.
Yes. I think it was Frank. Well, unfortunately, I don't know what's going on with my computer right now, but all my memory appears to have be in use. And I mean, I would bring up that, huh?
Is it related to that distro upgrade that you started right before the show?
No, it's well past then, I think.
Yeah, it was Frank.
Yep. And he had some feedback on the Magia, as I recall, on the Magia review that I did. And he had also wished that there had been a little bit more about the command line version of the Magia's control center. And I, as I mentioned to him when I responded, I was not aware that there was a command line version of it. Because when I go in, I install the distro and then I put it through its paces, as they say. And that just didn't figure on my list. So I said what I wanted to do, and I unfortunately didn't get a chance to. I want to take a little look at that, a little more look at it, and just see what I can do from the command line, and then report back. So that's what I did. And then I think he also had a comment, as I recall, because again I'm not looking at the email, but there was a comment about the format of it, and I think the gist of that was that he thought that it seemed to work pretty well.
Format, like how to use
it was addressed to you at the very end. It was in response to your question. You probably didn't go down that far and read it, did you?
I didn't. Oh, it says in response to Tony's comment.
Yes.
I'm quite satisfied with the current structure of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
The informality and the humor, a quality humor. A quality far too many podcasts lack. Ooh, thank you.
All right, that's our edge. Humor is our edge.
As well as alterations between the longer news shows. So like the Fresh Looks. He likes Fresh Looks.
Yes.
Awesome.
And the longer news shows. That's a hint. We better wrap this up. Anyway, thank you, Frank, for that. I think there were a couple of other emails. Well, yep. Phil, mm-hmm. I think you got one. I don't know if you got it, but you were so quick to respond because it was a question about the person that wrote in. Had a question about something.
Yeah.
So we received an email from a man named John Smith, who is asking for more personal space.
I love his subject title. I was like, where are you when I clicked on it?
he's got a computer that has a couple of 500 gig hard drives in it, and he's looking how to create more partitions for different users, like /home/user1/home/user2, but keep all of those users on their own partition. Now, I'm wondering if that's really necessary, and if you can just use quotas instead, and just have /home, and then have a quota on a user that says, hey, this user can only use 20 gigs of space, this user can use 100 gigs of space. I sent him an email back. He looks to have plenty of free space on his machine, but I'll help him come up with a scheme. I apologize. to you, John Smith, that I haven't gotten back to you in a couple of days, I promise I will.
Yeah. So it's entering. It
been sounds busy
like
at work?
work stops?
Yeah.
And did we see the feedback from episode 244, Killing Chrome?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, there was that feedback, that too.
Yep, I like that one.
Mm-hmm.
He's got a alias. Maybe I'll throw this in the show notes. It's a just my two cents. So here's what I use for Killing Chrome. This is from Matt. And I have it in my bash alias as Kill Chrome. And it's kill-9, and then it's PS, aux, WW, grep chrome, grep by cream, awk, print, $2. Basically finds all the chrome instances and kills them. So, clever.
Hmm.
And I like that he's aliased it. That's smart.
Yeah. So the issue, what we were having that day is I wanted to kill just one window of chrome, not all of my chrome. So that would have killed everything. And it would just do it right away. You wouldn't. Yeah. It wouldn't like give you the option. It would. And most people don't want to have to go through and kill like 20 Chrome processes. So that would be awesome if you want to just kill it all and be done with it.
Yeah. But the problem is Tony was live streaming and we sent him a link that was hacked. And then and we're not going to do that again. Not on a live show. Hashtag is a separate browser.
He says as he crosses his fingers.
I might click something.
Well, I think Chrome they do sandbox things. That, you know, if you're using Chrome, actually, right. I'm using Chromium, and I think there's something wrong with my laptop. It has consumed all my memory. It's consumed all the RAM, and it takes 5 minutes for an action that I take on the keyboard to execute on the screen. Mm. But anyway, enough of that. These little sandbox processes, I think, kind of help with security. But I'll tell you what, I think over time, when I like to have maybe 15 tabs open, it can get very, very intensive. Perhaps that's my problem here.
There's a trade-off between how many virtual machines I can run and how many tabs I can have in Chrome. Think about that. OSs compete with Chrome.
Yes.
If you would like some live debugging help.
Oh, or, yes, Phil, or I would. Okay. Oh, was that to me or was that to someone else?
Yes. That's to you. Yes. Or if you'd like to wait after the show, I can help you with that.
Yeah, I was thinking this is probably getting logged somewhere, and I just need to see why this is happening. But it seems to happen when Chromium is open. Mm. So I'm using Chromium, the open source version of Chrome.
So speaking of browsers, has anybody tried Firefox 57?
No.
No.
Supposedly it is blazing fast compared to the old Firefox, which wasn't slow by any means.
Yes.
Right.
This just came out, this past week?
I believe so, yes.
Yes, I got the, unfortunately, it was on my Windows machine. I'm just kidding. But it was on my Windows machine, actually. I'm not kidding about that part. I got the update, and Firefox is really my backup browser. I use Chrome in Windows, and, you know, I give all my information to Google. But anyway, I noticed when I fired Chrome back up again that it just seemed to really move quite quickly. So I think maybe I'm going to reconsider what browser I'm using as my default.
For me, it's Firefox all day and night, and I use Chrome as my backup.
You know, Phil, if that's what you're doing, that's what I'm doing.
But I'm just one person. I can be wrong. But if you want to follow me down this browser pit,
this
go
path
ahead.
To destruction, yes. I will. But anyway, so. Okay, I'm so sorry. Where were we?
Listener
feedback. Oh, yeah. Okay, we're almost at the end. I was looking through our web, through the website comments, and we instantly got like 25 spam. So I'm trying to filter through all that.
Hey, we're popular.
With the spammers.
With
why did they do that?
With the 71 right. million email problem, you probably have.
I thought that was 711 million.
Yeah, whatever.
Somebody been looking at my email box? What?
Yeah, we're programmers. Off by one error.
Yeah. Be the one, not the zero.
All right,
zero,
so I think.
And one's
any other feedback before we move on?
Actually, I did find one. Billy. Commented on our episode 245, which was the Fresh Looks with Scott Hunter and Jeff Fritz about the .NET Core project.
Oh, yes.
And he says that he went through and he installed it. And he said, I never, he says, but really, I never, ever, not even in 26 years ago, saw a Hello World take 2 seconds to run. He says exactly 2.3 seconds.
I missed that email.
So that doesn't look like the promise of cross-platform wonder.
Oh, that's funny.
That we all were so happy about.
Oh. Wow.
So,
but and we thank Billy for letting us know about that.
Yeah.
All right.
Phil's corrected his 711 million records.
What are you guys referring to?
Yeah,
it's in the news.
Tony and I are in the dark over here. Oh, it's coming up in the news.
Yeah, it's the news.
Okay.
Can't make it old yet.
Well, I can tell you, I don't have that news item.
I do. That's how I got the number.
All right, so we're going to move on here. I think any more feedback that we have to share?
Yeah, we got to move on to distro.
There's spam feedback from our first episode, Ooja Booja Stan.
Oh my gosh, from what, 6 years ago?
It's spam. But it's yeah, it was.
Can somebody lock down those comments?
I'm wondering whether the WordPress spam agent thing broke, and I need to go in and check on that.
Mm-hmm. We just have to put caption.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be the solution.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Right.
All right. So, let's move on.
Moving on. And it just died. Soundboard. There we go.
Distro Fever, where we cover the latest hot distro releases and news.
All right, Distro Fever. Distro Fever.
Mm-hmm.
So, what distros are?
Are sorry, you? What distros? Discoing. What distros are you fever?
Disco fever?
I missed
over
it.
Here.
What distros are you feverish over?
Disco fevering about distros.
Look there at that Ghost BSD.
Yeah, you know, I'm gonna give that another try. I had it for a while, and then I kind of moved away from it. And found myself back in the Linux world, shockingly. And now that KDE Neon just keeps freezing on this machine, I'm going to put GhostBSD back on, which, of course, is based on FreeBSD. And the only thing about it that I found problematic is that it runs the GNOME desktop.
There's nothing so wrong with that.
No, I know it's not. Hey, and GNOME fans out there, please don't be offended. It's just a personal preference. And I know that you don't want to run that bloated KDE, and I completely understand.
I love the bloated KDE.
Yeah, no,
Speaking of KDE, Kubuntu 17 just dropped, at least a beta for it.
I was going to say, it's not October or April, so.
Beta. Beta yeah. 1. 17.10 beta 1 is released.
All right.
Artful Aardvark.
Hey, there was Red Core. You know, a distro that we really haven't heard too much about lately is Gentoo.
Oh, yeah.
When's the last time you really heard much about Gentoo? It just kind of, it doesn't really emerge much to.
Lack of emerging news.
That was just a spontaneous joke.
When but I was at the Open Source Summit in Japan, one of the Gentoo developers and release team members gave a presentation. That was pretty interesting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what was it on?
That it was how they build the different, they rebuild the kernels for Gentoo and all the different versions and test releases, release candidates, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Oh, good. And the reason why I mentioned that is Red Core Linux, which I had not heard of before. Is it a rolling release? I think it is. Yep. It's based on Gentoo. And I had not seen this in DistroWatch before, which doesn't mean it wasn't there. It's just that I'm not familiar with it. And then it's got Linux long-term support kernel 4.9.40. And then they also have 4.12 available in the repository, so if you want to use a newer kernel. So I guess the watchword here is flexibility. Hey, you can use an older kernel, or you can use a newer kernel.
All right.
So that's my comment on it. And I'm still in reboot mode, so.
Okay.
You know, I was just off the top of my head and a little bit off Phil's laptop.
I see Raspbian's on here. It was in the middle of August that it was released. And Raspbian, 2017-08-16. It's based on Debian 9 Stretch. Mm-hmm. But what's interesting about it is the window manager it uses is it called Pixel, I think? And
perhaps.
They changed
it. It actually works really well.
LXDE?
Yeah.
That's what
Oh, well, that is interesting. Yeah,
it was something, a year ago. Because I was last fall or this spring, I was messing with some Raspberry Pis and put it on there.
Tom doesn't update his Raspberry Pi very often.
It runs really well. I really like it. Especially on, I was doing it on Raspberry Pi 3s. And, well, actually, I had it running on Raspberry Pi 3, and then I threw it on a Raspberry Pi 0, uh-huh. and it still ran really good, and I was really surprised.
That's impressive.
Yeah. It looks similar to LXDE, but it still, functions slightly different. And it has, it has the top bar and a menu and blah, blah, blah. So it's intuitive, to how to use it. But it's snappy on this lightweight hardware. It's really cool.
Nice. Thank you.
I think that's all we got for DistroWatch.
Is that it?
I saw...
Kind of a holiday weekend DistroWatch.
Yeah, holiday Black weekend DistroWatch.
We're going to try to recapture some of the time that we squandered earlier.
Actually, I have one more. Black Arch was released this week.
I saw that.
And it's a penetration testing / security research distro based on Arch Linux.
It is?
Yeah. And it's one that I haven't gotten in and tried using yet. But if you're interested in what's the differences and somebody that's not a hardcore security researcher person to, what their mm-hmm. review of it, then a couple of years ago, the podcast Linux in the Ham Shack, they did a review with comparing Kali Linux and Black Arch. And they did the installs and how hard it was to get it working and stuff. And it was a really good discussion.
Well, there's also Parrot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Parrot Security.
Yeah, that they just came out with a release, I think, was it in July, I believe?
Yeah, I downloaded it and playing a little bit with it. I've been told overall it's better than Kali because it has more things integrated into it. And they work supposedly very well configured.
Cool.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the big thing you want to get into. Like, if you're not always doing it, you need something to help you get them configured for these tools to work right.
Yeah, putting all the tools together is a challenge. So doing it all in a distro is great.
Yeah. Very cool. All right.
Tech news and views.
All right. The news coming up. Do we want to let Tom start and then we'll can pick pipe
up,
in?
Now we'll pick up the pieces, but whatever you don't cover, we'll probably
right,
have.
All right, better right in here. So, Google made Japan go dark. I don't know if you heard this.
No.
Japan was upset, I'm sure, because Phil has some contacts over there. Were they affected by Google's BGP blunder? So,
it's
PGP. Did you say
BGP?
Oh, BGP.
Border Gateway Protocol.
Yep.
Oh,
it's a routing protocol. It's a routing protocol, and that's how your traffic across the internet, how it decides how to get to one server or another,
or doesn't go to Japan.
You sure it wasn't like a hack from North Korea?
No, it was a fat finger. Have you done any BGP? Like, you ever looked at it?
I have looked at it. I know about open source implementations such as Quagga, but. No, I don't have those sorts of skills.
It makes me wonder. So Google announced not that long ago that they want to rewrite the BGP protocol because it's overly complex, and there's very few people that understand how it works. Like, it's such a unique niche, and it's so easy to fat finger. And these fat fingers have occurred many times over the internet, never by Google. This is the first time that at least documented that I'm aware of that they goofed up the internet. But it's a pretty serious issue, and it's also way more complicated than it should be because it's one of those things that was supposed to be simple. Then the internet got big, and now it's not simple. So now they have a lot of problems. So, it was interesting. But Google's pushing to do another, and it's completely open. So they want everyone to adopt the new standard that's supposed to be very easy to manage BGP. Yeah, because right now it's anything but easy, which leads to these type of blunders. So
it'll be interesting.
Yeah, it'll be interesting.
Is it going to be compatible? Like, can you run BGP on one system and this new one
it's
on another
still
and have
BGP,
them still talk
but
to
it's implemented very differently.
Oh, so, okay.
So here's one of the weird problems they have with the BGP and the scalability issue. So before, giant blocks of the internet belong to one section. Like, we can just give this entire class of networks over here to this company or even to an entire country. Well, the internet got big and everyone started needing more IP addresses. So some of these, like schools and things like that, they broke out the blocks into smaller pieces. So what used to be a block that belonged to some, like Germany, for example, pieces of it belong to some guy in California, another piece belongs over here. So where that creates a problem is BGP used to be simple. If it began with a 10, it goes over here. And if it began with this, it goes over here. Well, now you've got it so parsed out, there wasn't enough memory in those routers to contain the tables needed to do it, because they never realized the internet was going to be big. So there's, once again, the protocol and everything was never meant to be more than we just route this first couple octets. Now they have to route all the octet.
Exactly.
But they just didn't think there was going to be more than, we'd need more than 640.
When they designed TCP/IP like many, many moons ago, it was not, I don't think anyone's seen the scale that was coming for this.
According to a picture on Wikipedia for Border Gateway Protocol, there is a definite uptick.
There's a hockey stick picture there, right? As far as the
as
curve.
as soon as about 2004, 2005 starts happening. So Border Gateway Protocol, these blocks that Tom's talking about are called autonomous systems, ASs. So you'll see numbers like AS9110, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And then they announce, these different autonomous systems announce how ISPs can communicate with each other and determine the quickest route to a destination on the internet. Am I getting this right, Tony?
Yeah.
You are a networking expert.
Right, yeah.
Professor Bemis.
Right. And the reason why that uptick happened is because of the IPv4 being a limited space, that people that used to have big blocks, you know, what is it, University of MIT or someone just sold off.
MIT is selling off a bunch of their blocks.
Yeah, a bunch of their blocks. So instead of saying go to 10.10 goes, not really 10.10, 10. whatever goes to MIT,
right?
Then now it has to say, well, 10.10.6 goes to MIT. And then, and that one used to be one entry is now split off into 250 entries, because then now it's going off to 250.
Yes.
But then, say you take 10 of those clients that now it goes off in separate, they can split that off to another 250. So then it just blows up the routing table.
Well,
and every entry takes RAM. And so these hardware that runs routing, you know, ISPs don't want to upgrade every, you know, a couple of years. So they'll go 10, 15 years without upgrading a router. So RAM, think about what RAM costed 15 years ago, and specialty devices. You know, so you, that's why there's limited RAM in these routers.
Right. And when you look at like the assignment, the DOD owns the 11 block. Like, everything that begins with 11 is owned by the DOD. And that was issued to them in 1984. So you talk about a very, this stuff's been established for a long time. So we're using the same numbering system. Think of anything we're using from that.
Well, there
besides
were huge
numbers,
blocks
so.
That were assigned to big companies like IBM and other companies.
Yeah. Like Ford has a /8, and the hospital I work for, we have class B, so it's /16.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most universities have a big system. You know, Wayne State has a /16.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and the reason I know the DOD block right away is because, did you guys see me post that the DOD logged into one of my clients' NVRs?
I did see that.
That's been fascinating. Mm. Like, they hammered away at it.
Are you sure they weren't trying to get some money in and they sold off that one section of their block?
Sure it wasn't somebody just kind of hacking in through there, you know?
Because that's millions of dollars you can sell off a section of one of those blocks.
Yeah, everyone's really confused. Apparently, the DOD leases out blocks. So there's that, and it's also serious. But a bot logged in with the default username
and
password and
wars.
Turned off the cameras. It did the log. All we had of all the logs, and it came in from an 11 IP address. So interesting. Wow. But that's a lot of talk. We should probably move on.
I got one last thing for BGP. Sorry to hammer away at this dead horse. If
hammer
anybody,
away.
If anybody is interested at all in BGP, about 70 days ago, someone spent something like 3,000 hours redirecting or rewriting route prefixes to draw Nyan Cat in BGP routes. And you can look up the AS15562 on ripe.net. And ripe is in regional internet registrar. And again, that's AS15562, and it should look like Nyan Cat.
That's great.
Yeah, it looks like a green cat.
That's wonderful.
Wow.
Yes, I like that.
What's the purpose of it?
Fun.
Yes.
Also, an enormous undertaking.
And it was probably one of those things. They were stuck on some really hard work issue, and they said, I don't feel like working. I'm drawing Nyan Cat.
Yeah, that. Okay, I can see how that would happen.
Mm-hmm. So, welcome to 2017, where pacemaker patients are told to visit doctors to receive a security patch.
Really?
Wow. Apparently, they found some flaws in several pacemakers. In a lot of them, because they have data reporting, which you can log into them, and people found ways to exploit it. So there's some minor patches that need to be done. So you have to go visit your doctor so you can upgrade your pacemaker. That was just... Yes. People need firmware upgrades now.
What happens if the firmware update freezes? Does your heart stop?
That's a good question.
That's why you need to go to your doctors to have it done.
Yes.
Well,
they're standing beside you with those paddles.
And yeah, this is not the first time we've covered a topic like this, because there was the girl who had a heart condition and a pacemaker at a young age.
Was she under 18?
She was like in her 20s, but she's a security researcher. Mm-hmm. And she's like, well, yeah, she's a woman. All right.
Adult
female.
Yeah.
With a pacemaker.
Time. That's all right.
Yes. That's all right. I don't mind our time. Anyways, she had a concern about a condition that she had, and that without having the knowledge of her own pacemaker, whether or not this condition could affect her life. And it was really hard for her to get this information out of the hospital. And they kept just wanting to blanket, you're fine. Turns out she wasn't fine. She did find a flaw in it. And she's now pushing to open source. She's an open source developer, and also pushing that I should know the code that runs my heart.
I remember.
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah. Because it's a very valid discussion.
Yeah, there's certain things that should be open source. For example, voting machine software should be all open source and available to be audited.
Wasn't she one of the keynote speakers at OLF one year, I thought?
No, that was Valerie Arora.
Oh, okay.
And it's a different person at the heart thing. But it's still a very important topic. And I should know the firmware that controls my heart. I don't think that's too much to ask for.
For type 1 diabetics, there's this project that's on GitHub. It's called OpenAPS. It's for a open source pancreas system, because a type 1 diabetic, your pancreas doesn't work. I would know. I've had type 1 diabetes for 27 years
and
now.
Do you have the source code to your...
No, I run a MiniMed insulin pump, but if I wanted to build my own robotic pancreas, I could.
Wow.
Just a little Raspberry Pi and...
No. Yeah.
So you're not so busy at work, you're building a robotic pancreas.
Right. Yeah, if you weren't so busy at work, you'd probably have that done by now. I'm kidding.
But it's, it's available.
That's cool.
It's
the same concept. Knowing what runs my... what software runs my body parts?
Yes.
I wonder, is that...
Oh, my gosh. We're not going down that path. What?
I'm wondering if you could compile it to run on... something
else's
other than
body.
Either x86 or ARM, you know, to run on...
or what's... ARM. I like that. I saw what you did there.
Run on ARM.
But, you know, what's that other little robotics?
Arduinos.
Yeah, because Arduinos are tiny. You know, the whole CPU and motherboard is this big.
Well, I imagine any of these pacemakers are all... Because they implant them and the batteries last a long time, so they have to run some specialized real-time... super basic instruction sets, because there's not, you don't want a whole OS in there. Well, you do maybe, because there's features.
You might. But,
I'd be open for helping build
tiny
one of those.
Core Linux.
But I'm not going to carve into your body. Okay.
I'm only for external robotics.
That's right.
Will we be like making a little pouch that it slips inside, like inside your tummy or something?
Okay.
All right. So this is kind of cool. I have read and agree
we'll be
to
the judge of that, Tom.
It's true. I'll let you guys judge me. I have read and agreed to the terms and conditions is the biggest lie on the web, and we aim to fix that. That is the slogan for the guys at TOSDR.org. Terms of Service didn't read. What they do is it's an add-on that lets you know, and it kind of summarizes terms of service and what BS you're agreeing to. So they kind of cut through the legalese of lots of different ones and talk about it. You can just, if you don't want to use the plugin, you can simply search the site and look for things like YouTube, SoundCloud, GitHub.
And what
are you agreeing to?
What is that?
TOSDR for Terms of Service Didn't Read.
.org.
Oh, .org.
Yep, yeah. .org. Okay. And it's really cool. I mean, they have Netflix, Dropbox, Instagram, and it's really cool. They've got a lot of things, and they tell you what's in there. So you, because you probably said yes when you signed up for your GitHub account. Did you actually read it, Phil?
Or did you just scroll down there because you were forced to because of the way they set it up?
Exactly. They usually
yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
They have their own little like rating system, right?
Yes.
And if you have this plugin running in your browser, every time you go to a website that they have rated, it'll show you what their readability or their
readability and what's in there of whether or not it's good.
Hey, yeah, wait a minute.
Whatever their
did anybody read the terms of service for this website?
Good point.
Let's scroll all the way to the bottom. It's
I
not
did
stopping.
Already. I'm looking for it. But that was just purely for a joke, but
yeah. But I think it's really cool that they do this. And it's interesting because there was a joke inserted in a terms of service for a long time by a company because they said no one reads terms of service. So it said in there, if you read this and find this in here, we will send you $300. And it took 5 years before someone claimed it, something along those lines. It was years. You can find the story.
Really?
Yeah, it was a software company. And it says the first person to get it claim it. So they had a fallout zone case. Everyone found it at once because they knew once it got shared on the internet, everyone would start making the claim. But I guess the first so many people they would give money to, and it took years before anyone ever found it.
That's interesting.
And they did give the person the money, and they made a big deal about it. And they took it out. But they said, we just really want to prove no one reads any of this.
Yeah.
So it's entertaining, but I thought it was a cool site to summarize that.
Oh, it is.
I don't want to read it.
Tom, let me just say, Tom and everyone, that Twitter, because you know I tweet a lot now, Twitter deletes its tracking data in 10 days and offers an opt-out. So they get a thumb up from the site.
Wow.
Yes.
Very cool.
Yes.
Which is good, especially because the Department of Justice, which has been spanked back for now, they're going after DreamHost for all their logs.
I saw it's
a giant witch hunt where they just said, give us all your logs to all the things related to this company that you're hosting for. And they've said no.
Oh, and there was that, and then the Justice Department.
They actually
Department,
specified the client?
They're making them specify what they're looking for. You can't just have every log for the last however long. So.
Well, that would defeat the purpose of their request.
Right.
And then there was the request for, I think there was like an anti-Trump website.
And that's what that's related
to.
Oh,
that's the same one.
The same
one. Okay, I'm sorry.
DreamHost was the hosting company for it.
For it, okay.
And what they wanted was basically the entirety of all the logs. So it's good that Twitter's deleting the logs. And that's what all these companies are. If you don't keep logs, you can't subpoena me. That's.
Hey, did you know that Netflix may change their terms at any time at their discretion without notice to you?
That's a common thing. It's in a lot of them, and which is an
open. Actually, I would say show me terms of service that doesn't have that in there.
A couple open source ones. That's
yeah.
it. So I thought, yeah. So this is really cool because they integrated into their interior design at Cloudflare at their San Francisco office a bunch of lava lamps that are in the front lobby, which both look really cool and serve a purpose. It creates entropy. So they have a camera system watching it, and that's how they build the entropy that runs Cloudflare. And if you're not familiar, Cloudflare is the caching service that runs about 10% of the internet right now at last count. So they are a big deal. And they offer DDoS protection and everything else with the Cloudflare platform, and a really cool company. But they're building entropy off of that. And it's also a very visually cool thing to look at. Because
right.
lava lamps have a unpredictable nature of melting wax and water, which popularized themselves in the 70s. Maybe some stoners watching melting wax and water, fascinated by the entropy created. And someone says, hey, we can apply that to get real random numbers. So
right.
they use an algorithm to figure out the position of all, rows of lava lamps watching.
Do you think
that
cameras. Was a fully baked idea?
Fully baked idea. There's some hippie work in there, and it says, you know, I want to know how that went at the table. Like, we really need a good source of entropy, and there's engineers drawing stuff, and there's some dude go, dude, like lava lamps. Right. I could build all of them in your lobby, and you're like, what?
Right. So what entropy, what Tom's talking about is, like, I'll just give, for whoever's not our super uber listener, that they, entropy is how, like, crypto and all sorts of things, you know, who's not uber of uber techie.
Yeah.
But so any kind of crypto and all sorts of other systems need a random number. So there's this program that Linux has and all sorts of systems have that create a random number, but it's not truly random. You have to seed it with something. You know, you have to give it a number or something to say, start from here and give me a random number. And that's still just considered a pseudo-random, because for true randomness, you have to have...
lava lamps.
It has to come from, like, the universe, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it has to be an analog source, really. And that's what's awesome about a lava lamp. What they do is they took 1,000 pictures a second, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And then they hash every single of those pictures. And then those hashes are the seeds for the pseudo-random generators.
Yeah, it's really cool. I just like, how do you get true random and make a cool display? It's functional, it's beautiful, and it works.
And depending on any ambient light that's coming in, anything else that's going on in the background, you couldn't recreate this if you had the exact same lava lamp setup.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, I can give you a random number. Unfortunately, it's always going to be 4, so and you could use Phil's random number generator.
Yeah, Phil's not a good source of entropy.
4.
Right. And for things that are ultra-sensitive for random numbers, you know, they'll grab random, or not random, but specific items off of your computer and then use that for a
seed. In a random
order? So it'll be like,
order?
Move your mouse.
Yeah.
And it'll take that movement and create that seed for your random generator. But for something that's, you know, extremely important, like what Cloudflare does, and with so many clients and needs, has to be truly random because they're running millions and millions of transactions a second, that you need to have an ultra random, you know, setup.
An ultra uber random setup.
Speaking of Cloudflare, if anybody out there is looking for their own PKI to run at their company and they don't want to run something like Microsoft AD, Cloudflare SSL is an accessible PKI system for someone to use. It's got good documentation and it's open sourced and available on GitHub.
That's a CA that you can run in your
Yep, it's called CFSSL.
Oh, cool.
That's awesome.
We just call you the CA guy.
Phil's an expert on it.
That's right.
No. not.
That's how you know you've learned enough about it, the fact that you're willing to say you're not an expert on it. There's a threshold of, I'm an expert on it. Then when you've learned a lot about it, you're like, I'm not, and no one is. Once you've crossed into that threshold now. I know enough that I never can know all of it. It's that realization of it. I didn't know this, and this came up a story on The Verge. They sensationalized the headline, but it was still an interesting read, and it led me to something else, a free book we can have. So Steve Jobs tried to hire Linus, and he...
Really?
And, of course, Steve Jobs being how he was...
And, of course, Linus gave him the finger. No.
That's what I want to know. Did Linus give him the finger? And then I'm aware if he didn't, but I hope he did, and because it would have been funny. But apparently, if he would have done that, he really tried to entice him with money, and he probably would have made a lot. He wanted him to work on it. But, of course, we know how Apple works. We would have had a restriction that he wouldn't have been able to spend his time on the mm-hmm. Linux kernel. So I'm glad he didn't take the job. But apparently, and I didn't read the book yet because I just found it when I was doing the show notes yesterday, that you can get his book called Just for Fun on archive.org. So I'm leaving the link in the show notes. And it's the story of an accidental revolutionary, and it is supposed to be a really good read on how Linus came about and put this all together. And, of course, the book is free, and you can just download it on archive.org, or you can go buy it if you want a physical copy. But it is available.
That's cool.
And apparently there's a lot of section in there where he talks about his Steve Jobs and his requests and things like that. So that was kind of cool.
Yeah.
Ryzen is the new AMD processor. Me and Tony were talking a little bit before our two late arrivals, Phil and Mary, got here. AMD's new processors.
I had to drive the farthest.
She had to drive farthest.
This snooze takes me button. 30 minutes.
And yeah. Phil presses snooze button the most
Phil
times.
Phil and 30 mile Mary.
Thank you, everybody, for waiting up for me.
We're good.
You guys were here within like 3-4 minutes of each other, so it's not a big deal.
Even less than that, because I had just gotten in. And
so the very first Ryzen processor, the very first ones that came out, had a few segmentation fault problems potential with Linux that were discovered. And if you were compiling things in parallel, you could possibly have a segmentation fault. So AMD had a little bit of a rough start with them. So they're pushing hard to get Linux reviews out because they fixed it right away. But, you know, people wanted to know, okay, how does it work? Now, the exciting thing about Ryzen is the things you want is fast processing times. And you start with Ryzen and you go into their next series of processors referred to as their Threadripper processors, which are the higher-end enterprise ones. But about how long does it take to compile a kernel, Phil?
It took us about 2 hours yesterday on a specific piece of hardware we were using.
Yeah.
Oh, that was like specialized, like a slow processor? Or?
No, that was a Kaby Lake.
Really?
This is why Intel's a little scared of the new AMDs. The new Threadripper one, their high-end processor, Phoronix just reviewed it, 36 seconds.
What?
It can. Whoa. You're talking about like 36 cores in a processor, some of them. They are amazing. Like, and the other problem is, like, sitting over on our table here is one of the older Opteron processors. And then the downside of the older ones of AMD, they were high wattage, which, of course, in data centers, that tallies up really quick to have high wattage.
These lots of
power and high wattage comes with also heat, the other enemy of data centers. These Threadrippers use less wattage than their Intel counterparts. They are cooler than the Intel counterparts, and they are way faster. So Intel is going, uh-oh. Because these could be the goal is AMD wants to take over the data center market with them. And so that's why they're doing all these Linux benchmarks. And they have very strong support for virtualization.
Ooh.
So they have all kinds of – they have like all – is that something Intel always had was like extended enhancements for virtualization. Apparently they have everything Intel does, but they do it faster and cheaper because the processors are half the price. Not quite half the wattage, but definitely a lot more speed.
Well, okay, cool, because I know that those AMDs won't have the Intel management engine in them. And,
right.
And then I don't have to disable AST, I think it was, back beginning of June, end of May. For anybody that doesn't know, the Intel management engine is a backdoor for the big three-name government agencies.
The three letters?
The three letters.
Did you hear about that my next article after that one is the NSA backdoor in the IME? Did you hear about this? They just solved it.
No.
They just solved it?
This gets really interesting. The NSA backdoor is different than you think, and this literally got published only a couple days ago, so you may be interested. So like Phil was talking about, the IME engine that Intel has that comes turned on. Now, it runs without the processor. Like, you can take the processor out, and it still works. The IME engine is its own operating system, its own stack, and it's basically for things like a remote controlling server board, so it has a purpose.
It's on its own chip.
Yes. But the NSA, it turns out, made a request to Intel. NSA realized that a closed-source stack running at that level would be scary inside their environment. So the NSA had a disable code, opcode, added that could be sent to it to actually turn it off completely.
Really?
And the NSA secretly requested that Intel not put a backdoor in it, but put something so the NSA, as it ran in their server farm, could disable it. So someone finally cracked and reverse engineered the firmware, and they publicly did the full disclosure. And in short, yes, they have a summary on just how to use the NSA hack. They asked Intel to respond. Intel goes, it's a not supported feature. The NSA people are kind of going, that's
unsupported,
how we
turn it. Undocumented.
Yep. All you do is send an opcode to it, and just powers it off. It's like, boom, it's an off switch. It's a kill switch built.
Was that something you have to run across the network, or is it on locally?
I think you have to run it locally on the system to get it to disable, but there is a method by which it can be disabled. Because the interesting problems, there's a couple of open source projects or open source security research teams that tried disabling the IME, and it would sometimes just break the motherboard completely. The motherboard doesn't like it. And even desoldering it type stuff didn't work. So there's some real issues. Like, it would cause other problems with the board. You can't just say, I'm going to smash the chip. it, the board some has some type of reliance and check that it does for it. So that's why difficulty in removing it has been so such a pain in the butt.
Now, is this opcode? Can you use it on really any Intel?
I didn't get too much into it because there's a lot to.
Oh, gotcha.
Yeah, there's a lot to it, but I do have a link into their security research, and they published all their stuff. So, yeah, they can get in there. But it's still, the point is, we figured out a way, folks. We can disable it, and like I said, it's obviously a concern because this board also over sitting over here, even though it's AMD, still has that. That's common for our high-end boards, even if they are AMD boards, to still have Intel IMEs because it's such a standard in DevOps for management of physical hardware. Mm. So there's a lot of control software for it, so you can, you know, reboot remote machines and things like that. So as much as we have a need for things like that, it's scary when it's closed source, and we found the flaws in it.
Thank you.
So last couple news articles, members of Trump's Cybersecurity Council resigned in protest. So I got an article on The Verge about that. And in short, basically they found security flaws and said they prioritized the things we need to help protect the U.S. from cybersecurity threats. And they said, no, we're not doing any of those things. And they're like, well, then why are we here? We went through the trouble to put together the list. Can we act on the list? And they're like, no, we don't want to fix these voting machines. We don't want to fix this or protect us. So
can't say I'd stick around and waste my time either.
You know? Yeah. And that's kind of what it comes. Some people think they should stick there. And I'm like, the reality is if you're ineffective and if you have a boss who absolutely will not let you do the things that allow you to secure the company, do you even waste your time doing it? So,
you know, not to become like a bashing session, but that's not the first department within the White House that's done that people have left because of that.
I think I read this morning there are 411 vacancies now across all those departments that were supposed to be filled for this type of consulting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of them left for the same reasons of they said they had us all get together and suggest ideas and then none of them got implemented. There's a common theme we're seeing across the board with them.
Now,
I think it's that push for smaller government by attrition.
But do you think that makes us a weaker country? Instead of making us a stronger country.
If there's not an overarching strategy for this, because I think government could get leaner or should get leaner a bit. There's probably a lot of duplicity or, you know, duplicate activities. But if it's just done in a kind of a willy-nilly approach where there doesn't seem to be kind of a broad-based strategy for this, then I think it does. Because then certain things are not going to get done. I just think it does. I mean, but that's just my opinion.
There's a lot of issues, infrastructure and things like that. I mean, when you think about it, as we become so much more dependent on everything technology, we really need to think about that because that's where the next warfare is. It's all about information warfare. It's about shutting AI. Down services. If you break part of the internet, that's why Japan was so concerned when Google broke a section of the internet for them, is that stops commerce. Because how much of the commerce is done online? You know, every restaurant, you can't even swipe the credit card and it all goes to the internet. It's not even using phone lines anymore. So when the internet goes out at restaurants, they can't even ring up customers. It's some of the most basic level things start to stop. So,
and just one other little piece I want to put in here. I think it was several months ago where Treasury Secretary Mnuchin said that AI, artificial intelligence, they're not the least bit worried about that as far as it's supplanting jobs for the next 40 to 50 years. And I'm thinking to myself as I read other articles that talk about, hey, retail may be coming back, but it's going to be coming back with less workers because it's going to be automated. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, we need to have some really broad strategy for a number of things. And I just don't see it happening.
I mean, there's some issues related to this. So
I believe that's where universal basic income comes into play.
Yes.
But then I saw some person who I vehemently disagreed with, which was, I think all of this talk about
free money?
less work and more free time is actually ruining this country. And I think that's asinine.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, not to kill the conversation, but
this
really isn't a social.
That's
true.
We had Linux computers in front of us when we made those comments.
We will get back on topic. All right, my last sorry, two everyone. Quick articles is three not one, not two, but three hard-coded backdoors discovered in Aeris modems, which if you're here in the U.S. specifically, I know Wide Open West uses those Aeris ones. Comcast uses something different now, but the Aeris modems are really common with a lot of the cable companies, and they left hard-coded backdoors with port 22 SSH opens that you can get into these.
I'm pretty sure AT&T U-verse are Aeris modems also.
I think they use Aeris modems as well. So I have the details of which models are affected. I don't know if they have a patch yet for them. Sorry. One of the things we do for our clients, because a lot of people say, well, isn't it just adequate to use the cable modem provided by the cable provider? And I'm like, you generally get poor support for them, for one. Two, the problem with them is you can't disable a lot of those features. So if I wanted to port forward 22, for example, the Comcast ones, they have open management ports, which mm-hmm. we have to have clients pass PCI compliance because they do credit card. We simply can't disable the management ports. The only way to fix them is put them in bridge mode and use a real firewall. Our preference is pfSense, but occasionally it's CU edge router. So once you bridge them over, you bypass all those features because the Aeris modem becomes transparent.
So it's bridged over to the pfSense right. box, which then goes out to the internet.
Yeah, and then it just bridges over, yep. and then it keeps you from the vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. We always are encouraging people to get rid of, even if it's the most basic of them, even if it's your home use. Mine's in bridge mode. My Aeris modem, I didn't look and see if my model is affected, but I don't care because I bridged it right away. Which, of course, was quite the task. So, last quick thing is the 711 million. Last quick things. Record online spam dumps. So there is 711 million records of an online spam. And it's lots of usernames and passwords to 711 email addresses. 711 million email addresses.
Whoa.
We have seen an uptick in spam ever since this got released. Like, a lot.
Wow.
So, yeah. Which seems like how we got affected by listener feedback. It was probably all those spam bots from that dump.
Probably.
Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's it for the news and for me. What do you got?
you covered all mine. I'm kidding. No, I actually have a couple.
Simlink to Tom.
Yeah. Simlink to Tom. Yes, that's right. No, actually, there was something in Datamation this past, I think it was, yeah, on August 30th. So that must have been, what, Thursday or so? Maybe Wednesday. It's 78 open source replacements for expensive applications. And, you know, from time to time we see these little pages come out and I kind of scan through and I say, oh, okay. Oh, yeah, sure. I know about GIMP. I know about Inkscape. But actually this one kind of caught my eye because there was one that I was not aware of. And you guys know what a DAW is, right? It's a digital audio workstation.
Yeah.
And so in the closed source Windows world, there's some really powerful DAW applications. So the listing here had Audacity, it had LMMS, which is the Linux multimedia system, whatever it's called. A studio, not system. The one that kind of caught my eye, because I'd never heard of it, is called Frinica, Frinika. Hmm. Now, I just found this yesterday, so I haven't had time to take a look at Frinica. And I was wondering if anybody, it's supposed to replace Apple Logic Pro 10, which is a $200 program, as well as the FL Studio Producer Edition, which is another $200 program. So it's a Java-based tool. But I was kind of curious if anybody's familiar with Frinica.
I haven't heard of it. It allows
you
to,
create, you know, you can.
Why do people still put things on SourceForge?
I'm not sure.
They made a comeback.
Is that where it is? Frinica?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but it looks cool. There's a video demo. And
yeah, so that caught my eye. And, of course, they've got business process management stuff, CAD, customer relationship, or, you know, CRM, a whole bunch of different categories, and they've got these replacements for them. So that was one that I found. Another one that I found was, here we go. There's been a petition. You know, they have that petition site. What is it? Not petition.org, but it's...
change.org?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's it, Tom. Thank you. See, Tom's an extension of my mind.
My favorite one was still to rebuild the Death Star. But
yeah. But anyway, there's a petition there, and this was out on the xdadevelopers.com site, which is an Android developer's site, and so... So it has to do with that, but it's a petition to ask the developers of Phoenix OS to open source their kernel, because apparently Phoenix OS is a desktop version of Android, and there was that other there was another Android desktop version which apparently has either not been updated recently or maybe inactive, whatever.
Is it Android x86?
You know, it might be.
Yeah.
But But anyway, so I thought that was kind of interesting, and I'm thinking of downloading and installing this just to see how it is, if it is installable by me. But it's a full desktop version of Android, and it's they said as far as they – oh, you know, there was one called Remix. I think the other one was Remix. Not that – I think that Android x86 is the – basically you take your phone and you put it on your desktop.
No, Android x86 is actually an install.
I installed it.
Android on x86 processors.
Right, yep. But it looks like a phone.
Yeah.
So similar. So this one might look a little different. So I think maybe it warrants a fresh look.
All right.
So if I can download it and install it without a problem. If, as long as partitioning's not involved, I should have no problem. But anyways, so
just say use the defaults and wipe everything.
Yeah, right. So they're trying to. I guess there's some really dedicated fans of this platform, so they're trying to get this this kernel open source. So it'll be interesting to see if they're able to do that.
Very cool.
Because you know how Android started off as open source, and then it's slowly. I mean, there are parts of it that are no longer open source, and I think.
And I don't think Oreo's getting backported to the open source, because what they do is they create the new one, and then there's a kind of a pushback. Yeah, like they go, okay, here's everything that we're going to release, which is the majority of it. I mean, things like the Play Store are still not going to be in there, but it's kind of a cool thing. Mm-hmm. Someone said, and I have not taken time to research this, that they're not going to be doing that with Oreo.
Okay.
And Oreo's interesting because it's a very big rewrite of it. So.
Right. It's not based on AOSP anymore, right?
That's why I think it is. They kind of broke away from AOSP, so.
We're getting shout-outs from the IRC channel. So, hello.
Hey,
everybody. Oh. Hey, are you sure it's not?
Well, there's all sorts of conversation going on. Holy cow!
Could be
errors and scary guy.
Uh-oh. What's that?
I don't know about the scary guy.
Scary guy. Who is that scary guy?
I don't know.
Who is that scary guy? All right, those are my news stories because we are definitely running over.
Yeah.
So people who like us to be an hour, oh my gosh, we're so sorry.
Yeah, this is easily going to be a 2-hour show.
It's happened before.
Let's redo it.
Very our content's so good, though.
Very short news for me. Nmap turned 20.
Yay.
On September 1st.
Hey, that's still my go-to tool. We use Nmap a lot.
Yep, mm-hmm. Same here.
So, very cool.
Thank you, Phil.
I don't have any news, but I have a few Linux projects I ran across that I thought was really cool.
Uh-huh.
And one is Gping. It's a graphical ping, so it gives you it's graphical, like Ncurse is graphical, so it's still in your what's that?
Sorry, Errors was saying, "Hey, I'm on TV," so I pointed my screen at YouTube. So now he's technically. Sorry, Tony.
He's not wrong.
But Gping, it still runs in the command line, but when you ping, it gives you a graphical. Like you know, a graph of the response times. So I thought that was cool. I haven't used it yet, but it looks neat, and it's easier to read, other than seeing like 58 milliseconds, 126 milliseconds, blah blah blah, going down the side.
But I'm a graybeard. I'm used to command line only.
Right, but it is in curses, so you can run it through a command line.
All right.
Cool. And the other one is another command line utility. It's called Betty. I don't know if you guys have heard this. Betty?
I know one-eyed Betty's in Ferndale. It's a bar restaurant.
They got one of mine, too.
It's a Siri-like command line virtual assistant for Linux. Ooh. So you just type like a conversation into it,
mm-hmm.
and it translates that into a command to run.
Mm. Oh,
cool. Mm. Yeah, I thought that was really cool.
You know, speaking of those things, I think Alexa and Cortana there's been some integration done so they can talk to each other.
Yeah.
Yep. So a couple of examples are, instead of typing, who am I, and it gives you your username. You type in, Betty, what's my username? And
that sounds more efficient.
Well, if you don't know the who am I command. This is for people that really don't know the command line all that well.
Yeah.
Quit looking at me, Tony, when you say that. Saying,
that's more letters. I counted them.
All right.
And then it responds with, it says Betty, and then it says running, and then it runs, and it tells you the command. It runs,
uh-huh.
and then it responds with that, whatever the command would. Or you say, Betty, what's my kernel version? And then its response is, Betty, running, uname-a. And then it gives you your...
It's like Nancy. Isn't that like Nancy? You had Nancy in our IRC.
Yeah, Nancy's broken right now. She's been broken for like a year.
Nancy's a broken woman.
is Nance.
I'm not the one that said that.
Betty is a Ruby project. You can find it on GitHub.
Cool. All right.
Nancy on GitHub or Bitbucket or anything like that?
Yeah, it's not actually called Nancy. I called it Nancy. It's a IRC bot, and it's actually called Jenny is the project.
So Nancy.
Jenny, but I.
He thought Nancy sounded more.
It was a joke.
More
no,
mature.
So no, it was a joke against Matt because he hated Nancy Pelosi. So I named it Nancy.
Oh, that's funny.
Oh, yeah. When my wife goes to work, she's really just the bot in the SMLR channel.
Yeah.
Now, if you
all right,
if I ever yeah. wanted to have an existential crisis, I just type "Who am I?" and it tells me root, but my name is Phil.
Yes. You shouldn't be running all as right. root. Or you can say, you know, another example is, you know, what month is it? Betty, what month is it? And then it says running date and then plus parentheses, A? Not parentheses, but B.
I am root.
Yeah.
I am root here.
You know, what is my IP address? It gives you your IP. Actually, it gives you an option. If you say, what is my IP address? It says, do you want ifconfig for your internal or do you want curl-s/ to get your public external address? And then you say one or two, and then it responds with that command.
So how many of those examples are you going to share with us?
I promise this is going to be a two-hour show. Come on, we can keep on. There's like 30 more. No, I'm just joking.
We're going to go all the commands.
All right. We're going to make it. Yeah, we're going to drive away all of our listeners. All right.
So I just thought that was kind of cool. All right. So, Phil, I don't think you had a chance to talk about news.
Oh, I said Nmap had its birthday the other day.
Yeah, where were you?
That's about it. And you can upload malware to fcc.gov, and they'll host it. They'll also host your images and videos up to 25 megs.
Wow.
This might be patched now, but you could use them. Up until just the other day.
As a hosting company.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's great.
FCC.gov.
Oh, my goodness.
And you didn't have to sign. You didn't have to sign anything. Because of a bug in their uploader code. You could get the token that you needed without all the legalese.
That's
even better.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah.
Hey, question. Being that you're a SEDOC guy, do you have any cool scripts on your GitHub for Nmap to filter and parse it? Or do you just dump it all raw?
He's asking for a friend.
Asking for a friend.
I usually just parse it raw. So typical commands that I run are nmap-T4, space-A, and then a host name, nmap-v, nmap-S, space-P and a zero, or a P and an N, something like that.
We do a lot of those because we do ping sweeps. We have to do that. We have a camera system, which I'm going to be there Tuesday auditing. They can't remember where they put all the cameras, so I have to go there, and the first thing I do is identify all of them. So we just use ping sweeps. The cameras all ping respond, but we don't know which IPs are free and things like that, so that's how we find them all.
Ah, mm-hmm. Gotcha.
And build our list, start managing the network, so...
Good way to do it.
Yeah. Just to know if you had an XML exporter for it, because that would be so handy. Or CSV. Someone has some code for it, but it's broken.
If you want it to be in CSV, you just say, you know, printf to, you know, pipe it to print.
A little trickier than that with Nmap, it turns out. Someone's wrote some scripts, but they're dated.
I'll help you out after this show.
Okay, cool.
I did I did some log grepping for work. And I had it print like the five or six columns, and I put commas in between them so that when I send it to my boss, it opens right up in Excel.
Well, and it works great for the log grepping, but with Nmap, because it puts pieces of data below the other one, it's really tricky.
Yep.
I know I wish it wouldn't do
that. Well, you can tell it to ignore the return, or you can remove the return.
Yeah, that's what I need to do.
Yeah.
That's why I said Phil had done that already. replace returns with commas. And then
yeah, exactly.
Just, yeah.
All right.
And then I just throw headers
and
on
said,
it. So.
Said will do that, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, Phil will, because I don't know said very well. The guys whose license plate is said awk.
I'm the living impersonation of that tool.
Phil parses data, literally.
That's cool.
Phil said so.
Oh, boy. Do we have music?
We do. Oh, wait. I need to... We're sorry.
All right. We have music.
Yeah, I have to get back to the soundboard. All right.
The outgoing music for this week's show.
So the outgoing music is, now how do I get, this thing is so old, it doesn't have like a, I don't know how to find the, do I hold it down? There it is. You know, the running apps. I'm sorry, me bambling. My favorite Creative Commons band is called Brad Sucks. And if you've been listening to the show for a while, you know we played their music often. So I figured it's been a while since we played it, so we're going to go ahead and play one of those. And I'm going to randomly scroll and hit my finger, and that'll be the song we play. So I love those songs. And we've come to the end of the show. So you have been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This was episode 247. Number challenged?
Yeah, number challenged.
Memory challenged?
Memory challenged.
Yeah, all of them.
This is Tony Bemis.
Mary Tomich.
Phil Parada.
And Tom Lawrence.
See you next time.
What are we taking a fresh look at this week?
Wrong one.
You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. If you would like more information about this or other shows, go to smlr.us. Feel free to send comments to show@smlr.us or give us a call at 734-258-7009. I'm John Miller. If you don't like it, you can
bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.